elegy. Our hammock slung between Americas, we miss you, liberty. Che's bullet-riddled body falls, and those who cried, the Republic must first die to be reborn, are dead. The freeborn citizens ballot in the head. Still everybody wants to go to bed with Miss America. And if there's no bread, let them eat cherry pie. But the old choice of running, howling, wounded wolf deep in her woods, while the white papers snow...
West Indian writer and Nobel laureate Derek Walcott reading from his collected poems. That one is entitled Elegy, and Derek Walcott will read it in its entirety in just a few minutes. Welcome to Soundings, a magazine about books and ideas from the National Humanities Center. I'm Wayne Pond. Partial support for Soundings comes from Carolina Power and Light, where listening generates powerful ideas. Derek Walcott was awarded the Nobel Prize for Literature in 1992. He's here now to read from his work, talk about it, and reflect on the role of poetry in today's global economy and mass culture. We begin with a selection from Walcott's collected poems, an edition covering the years between 1948 and 1984. The name of the poem is A Map of Europe.
A Map of Europe. Like Leonardo's idea, where landscapes open on a water drop, or dragons crouch in stains, my flaking wall in the bright air maps Europe with its veins. On its limbed window ledge, a beer can's gilded rim gleams like evening along a Canaletto lake, or like that rocky hermitage where in his cell of light, haggard Jerome prays that his kingdom come to the far city. The light creates its stillness. In its ring, everything is. A cracked coffee cup, a broken loaf, a dented urn become themselves, as in Chardin or in bare bright Vermeer, not objects of our pity. In it is no lacrimae rerum, no art, only the gift to see things as they are, halved by a darkness from which they cannot shift.
Nobel laureate Derek Walcott reading from his collected poems. That was a selection entitled A Map of Europe. You're listening to Soundings from the National Humanities Center. I'm Wayne Pond. To begin our conversation now, I asked Derek Walcott about the themes of his poetry and the literary expression of the West Indies, which grew from a people subject to political and cultural imperialism.
Well, I don't think we can be called any more subject people. Theoretically, politically, the Caribbean and a lot of the Commonwealth and what used to be the British Empire have become independent. The echo of what was there before is still around, as it is in my own span of time. Mm-hmm. I don't think it's easy to eradicate the experience of evolving into something that one might call independence. And I imagine that one could parallel almost synonymously the evolution of my own work in a way and the political evolution of the Caribbean, as would many of the writers of my generation from different parts of the ex-empire, mm-hmm. Some of them much younger. But still, I think the biggest haunting memory most recently would be the empire, the decline and change that followed the loss of the empire.
Mm-hmm. I noticed that in your collected poems, Mr. Walcott, you run from, what, the late 40s? Well, right up here through the late 80s and the early 90s. Mm-hmm. Do you find politics an inspiring theme to you? How do you come to your political and artistic expressions here in the 1990s, given what you've just said about how empire is really rather an old word and an old concept?
Well, one of the problems I have with time, historical time, is the authority with which, say, central powers divide time. In other words, you say the 60s and the 70s and 80s to me. Mm-hmm. I don't think we make those divisions. And those divisions that you make every decade, we are forced to accept as a concept that we have not gone through, perhaps. And what may be the 80s for you may still be the 70s for us. Uh-huh. Do you know what I'm saying? In terms of then, I think it's crucial, at least to me, to not to reject, but to examine the meaning of certain given premises that one can authoritatively divide time into decades. In other words, America, what happened? People talk this way in America, you know, the 60s are not the 70s. Well,
that's right.
We have to sort of catch up with what is meant by that, because then you are in a way dividing your time politically, uh-huh. quite apart from culturally. I mean, I think you do it politically. And that subliminally implies that whatever you divide has to be accepted by, you know, whoever listens to you.
Sure.
It's not an aggressive thing. It's simply right. something that I confront uh-huh. and sort of try to defy as much as possible. Because once you surrender into that idea of accepting concepts of time, you're bound to accept a lot of other concepts that have to be examined before they are accepted.
You use the word we. Who is the we that you're speaking of in
that
sentence?
Well, I would say anybody who is being addressed is the we.
We're talking about power here, aren't we?
It's an adjunct of power. And it's not, you're certainly not using the phrase vindictively or aggressively or, you know, imperially or anything like that. I'm just saying that in the same way that we can't divide the seasons into spring, summer, autumn, winter, we can't divide time, even historical time, into rhythms that are seen by the person using those that meter, that division.
Fair enough. Derek Walcott, how do you define yourself literarily? I read in the encyclopedias and the reference books about Derek Walcott as a man of mixed racial heritage. You have feet in several worlds. How do you define yourself as a creative, literary, expressive person?
I am a West Indian, and whatever that means is something very involved for me to go into. I'm particularly a St. Lucian, and even that has a lot of its own ambiguities and so on. In terms of race, again, there is ambiguity there from all sorts of conflicts. But my emphatic description of myself is that I'm a St. Lucian, but I don't say it with the authority that someone may say, oh, I'm a Parisian, or I'm from New York. You know, I'm just simply a St. Lucian. What that means in terms of an apparent lack of history and an apparent lack of culture is not how I judge the country I come from.
What about yourself as a literary person, Mr. Walcott? That is to say, you are devoted to, you practice forms of Western literary expression, and yet you come from a culture that finds itself, let's use large lineaments here, ideologically, politically, at odds with the Western inheritance. Is that for you a contradiction or a continuity?
No, I don't. There are a couple of historical facts. The West Indies is older than America, right? Barbados is older than America.
Fair enough.
Older than New York.
Fair enough.
So if we have to use historical terms, which I really detest, because then you get competitive, you know, oh, I'm older than you or something like that, you know. But I mean, if we have to use those terms in terms of time, the West Indies is an older culture in this part of the world than, say, America is. All right. Now, I don't know what that means, what use that is. But what it does say
is of use to a lot of literary scholars.
Well,
I can tell you that.
What it does say is that people were talking English in Barbados before it began to happen probably in America. And I'm talking about a kind, not quite apart from accent and apart from whatever else goes with that, I'm saying that the English language in our part of the world is an is as old as, say, the French languages or the Portuguese or Dutch language is in the Caribbean. So that there's a natural, it's not a matter of appropriating a language. It just became as natural for us to speak English as Americans to speak English. Mm-hmm. Now, the question of whether Africans should speak English would then enter a territory in which, you know, it would be a very dangerous kind of discussion.
Absolutely.
But I don't feel that I came to English as if it was something like a foreign language. It's just a part of my own inheritance as a writer, uh-huh. as a person, as a West Indian. And since I felt myself to be at least volubly entitled or naturally speaking English, then that would mean that I would have access to English literature. Now we get into an area in which somebody might say, yes, but you're not an Englishman. And the question is, to whom does the English language belong? The English language belongs to anybody who speaks it. And therefore, it's the same question you might ask of Joyce or you might ask of Conrad. You right. know, is this your language? You say, no, but I'm Polish, or no, but I'm Irish. That's an old question, but it's as much applies to Conrad or Joyce as it might to a West Indian writer.
Fair enough. Let me ask you to consider this, Derek Walcott. Where are your loyalties and your allegiances politically and artistically? Is there a dividing line between them? That is to say, you look to your native culture, indigenous is a dangerous, is a sort of flare word these days, but you look to the West Indies. You also look to the literature of the West, Shakespeare, Milton. You mentioned we could talk about somebody like Joyce. Yeah. Where are your literary models and allegiances?
But you see, I think you're implying that I think that there's a difference between my enjoyment of Joyce and an Irishman's enjoyment of Joyce.
Fair enough.
But I don't see that difference because as a writer, the language does not belong, as I said, doesn't belong to the person. It doesn't belong to the country you come from. I mean, what would you say to, I mean, the admiration one would have for Conrad's English would be to say, wow, he's writing as well as that and he is Polish. Uh-huh. But then if you took that and sort of broke it down, you know, microcosmically into little things, you'd say, wow, he's writing as well as that, but he's just a country kid from Warwickshire. How come he's writing so well? You know what I'm saying? I think the language, the empire that one serves is an empire called language, and you're part of that thing. And the whole idea of it is to, you know, to learn it, not to be a servant to it, but to try to dominate it and to use it. And I have as much a right to do that as, say, a French writer in Martinique, like Cizet, has to do that to the French language.
Mr. Walcott, there are words that one might use to characterize your plays, your poetry, your prose, words like castaway and the wide sea and odyssey and isolation and alienation. Do concepts like that still drive your poetry? What are you interested in now?
Well, I do a lot of stuff that is public and involves the audience. I mean, I write plays. So in a sense, there may appear to be a kind of contradiction of conduct by saying that basically every poet is in a culture, a castaway of a culture, in the sense that he's not at the center of the culture. By he, I mean he and she. But that the culture generally considers a poet to be someone in the outer limits of the culture.
Do you feel that way about yourself?
No, I don't feel that way about the Caribbean at all. I think I do feel that way, and when I look at American writers and when I look at myself in America and certain things that do happen to American writers for all sorts of reasons, there is a kind of castaway thing. The castaway thing that I speak of in terms of being in the Caribbean is the fact that in a sense, in my own life, I've had to make a castaway of myself or consider myself a castaway in the sense that I have to be outside a culture to consider it. I have to step back and look. There's a necessary isolation in every writer, you know, that he has to make an island of himself, that he has to look out from that position to make a judgment on himself and on his society. And the fact that there's no society in which poetry becomes a very active social thing, which it can be, as it used to be in certain societies, certainly in Greek society, the rhetorician was somebody voluble and philosopher was voluble and necessary and so on. That's gone, I think, in societies, except in certain societies that may still be considered primitive, but in which, say, the poet or the shaman is next to the ruler. You know?
What does that do to increase or decrease the responsibility of men and women such as you? Here you are, a Nobel laureate in poetry. What is your role in a mass culture in which, as you say, poetry finds itself marginalized? It is really not something that is at the on the front page all the time. It appears to be dwindling in our schools. How about this?
I don't think it's dwindling. I think there's always this image of poetry dwindling. I mean, poetry doesn't dwindle any more than the human heart is supposed to dwindle. I mean, it's there.
Well, that's good to hear that.
Well, it is. I mean, it's we're talking about the volume of expression, and I think there is a voluminous amount of expression in this country of poetry, whether it manifests itself in the best kind of rock writing, in the best aspect of rap.
So you find no contradiction, the high, the low.
No, I think if you take rap, for instance, which I don't really like, but the function of rap here is poetry serving a social function, because rap is in heroic couplets. And it comes out of the ghetto, and its function is to do something, you know, either to attack the police or it's used socially to do things or to defend oneself from.
What about poets such as you? I mean, here you have attained these high distinctions as an artist. You are, as it were, removed from the wide world. Now, I mean, here I sit across the table from you. There's a flesh and blood human being who lives his life in the popular culture of the West Indies and of the United States. Nevertheless, the popular perception is that you poets are out there in ivory towers and that you don't really have anything to do with the way society works.
Well, people don't admit to where they're affected by poetry. I mean, what does happen, I think, is what happens in the human condition, including war, including concentration camps, including the extremity of human suffering, that to say that poetry is removed from that is to forget the examples of endurance that have happened in people like Mandelstam in prison in Russia, is finding that he has to write poems, finding that he has to write something about the anguish of the unconscious of the human soul. And what does that do? Well, that means that, for instance, Mandelstam has survived Soviet Russia, because the truth of Mandelstam is a more permanent truth than the destruction, self-destruction of the Soviet Empire.
What did you survive, Derek Walcott? What is it that you look back on and that you have mixed feelings about, that you say to myself, thank God that's over with? Or do you? Is it that dramatic and severe for you?
No, nothing is over. As Edna St. Vincent Millay said, I think, life isn't one thing after another. It's the same damn thing over and over. So nothing really has changed, except I think as you get older, and I'm 65, you have a better sense of balance. You realize the injustice that can happen for all sorts of reasons, and you realize that I think what you more realize that is quite horrible as you get older is basically what a cruel animal man is.
Derek Walcott, let me put a few lines on the table here that seem to suggest the kind of thing that you have written about in your poetry, your drama, your prose. The gorilla and the Superman, the horn of plenty through a bitter cup. I fear what the migrant envies. How do words and concepts like that drive your artistic life?
Well, it's a benediction, not a mystery. I think that there may be moments of some curious elation or joy that may be, no matter what the condition the poet may be in, that makes the utterance happen. And I think it's similar to what happens with music.
Who or what is your muse, Derek Walcott?
You mean if I were giving myself a physical representation?
Sure. What is it? How would you describe that which inspires your work?
Well, if it's the theater, I've said this and it sounds stupid, but my idea of the ideal respondent in a theater is a big, fat St. Lucian woman laughing uncontrollably at the back of an audience. That's who I would write for, where she'd be slapping her legs and saying, please, you're killing me, stop it. Or weeping in the same way.
Is this an image that takes you back to your
boyhood? I never do it, but I should remember that responsibility.
Fair enough. Mr. Walcott, what do you say to the next generation of poets? Do you have a particular message or chant or refrain to them? Is there something that you want the new upcoming generation of artists to know about, that you feel passionately about?
No, I think one of the penalties of arriving at this age or surviving is to be asked to be, make bardic pronouncements, which is like terrible, because I wouldn't listen to anybody saying anything when I was very young.
Right.
But on the other hand, I would just say, wherever there is someone who male or female, you know, girl or boy, who can, wants to be a poet and may think that it's not worth it, and while they're doing it in whatever remote part of the world, or even in some over-excited and active and frightening part of the world like New York City or in normal Oklahoma or somewhere, that if that's your vocation, you have to pursue it. Your duty is to the pursuit of your vocation. And sometimes too many people really decide it's not worth it, and certainly it has nothing to do, obviously, with financial reward at the end of it. You know, it isn't everybody who can get all that money in a Nobel Prize, but that's not important. The Nobel Prize has nothing to do with the reality of poetry.
Well, what does have to do with the
reality of poetry? The life of the poet.
The quotidian, the practice of what you do every day as an artist.
I think poets, the morality that is there in poetry is quite frightening, and poets know it. I think they know that their lives are of no consequence. Whatever happens to them ultimately is of no consequence. And that's something people don't believe that poets believe, but I think we do, because basically I think our whole intention is to be anonymous, not important.
Mr. Walcott, we look around our global society in the mid-1990s. We see the emergence, what appears to be the blessing of the emergence of democracies sprouting up all over the world. The downside of that might be described as a sort of uniformity in our global politics, our global culture. What do you think will happen? What should happen with these sort of postage stamps sized literatures? How are they going to survive and retain their vigor and their color and their verve in a world of global mass culture? Is this a threat that I'm inventing that really doesn't exist out there?
Yeah, I think so, because I think by rights, poetry should have been exterminated. It should have been extinct by now, because everything has threatened it. If one, you know, from the Industrial Revolution to cholera, it's as much an expression of will as it is of inevitability. People will always wish to utter some articulation of their pain on behalf of others or on themselves. And I suppose the ideal thing would be if there were no pain, there'd be no need for art. I don't see, I mean, all I can talk about is what examples of fortitude we have had in the history of the world, in which, you know, people who do not wish to be heroes, who have no intention to be heroes, become phenomenally, spiritually heroic, because they may feel that unless they are that, then everything will just go to blackness.
Are you describing a burden that you feel, or one that you want
to
escape?
No, I mean, I've been lucky, you know. I live in a paradisal situation. I fly back and forth. I'm not somebody in a prison camp. I'm not somebody who's been tortured and who refuses to admit that the state is a superior conscience to his, like so many admirable. I'm a coward, I think, you know. And I think that all these people were cowards, but given the kind of confrontation of denial they have, you know, that's the ultimate test. If somebody hovers over you and say, do you admit that you are an animal? Do you admit that you will serve? And the person, however, even if the person says yes, inside the answer is no, then that no is unconquerable.
Here's a footnote to our conversation, Derek Walcott. Do you think that, realistically speaking, the role of the poet has anything to do with the world of politics as we take the measure of the way societies rise and fall? By virtue, for example, of having won the Nobel Prize, my guess is that you occasionally get to hobnob with the policymakers. And occasionally they might even listen to you when you offer an opinion or a comment on this or that social aspect of our lives. How about this? Is there a role there?
I flee from that. I don't do that.
Do you?
No, because there's a danger there. There's a danger of being drawn into the net of nodding to whatever the state wants to do, you know, whatever sincere, however munificent it may appear. I think you just step aside from that. Look on individually at what the thing may be, because perhaps the most treacherous kind of conduct is partisan conduct that can happen in politics.
Derek Walcott was awarded the Nobel Prize in Literature in 1992. He's the author of numerous collections of poetry, as well as plays and literary studies. You're listening to Soundings from the National Humanities Center. I'm Wayne Pond. Soundings concludes this week with another reading now by Derek Walcott from his collected poems. This selection is entitled Elegy.
Elegy. Our hammock slung between Americas, we miss you, Liberty. Che's bullet-riddled body falls, and those who cried, the Republic must first die to be reborn, are dead. The freeborn citizens' ballot in the head. Still everybody wants to go to bed with Miss America, and if there's no bread, let them eat cherry pie. But the old choice of running, howling, wounded wolf deep in her woods, while the white paper's snow on genocide is gone. No face can hide its public, private pain, wincing, already statued. Some splintered arrowhead lodged in her brain sets the black singer howling in his bear trap, shines young eyes with the brightness of the mad, tires the old with her residual sadness. And yearly lilacs in her dooryards bloom, and the cherry orchard surf blinds Washington and whispers to the assassin in his furnished room of an ideal America whose flickering screens show in slow herds the ghosts of the Cheyenne scuffling across the staked and wired plains with whispering rag-bound feet, while the farm couple, framed in their Gothic door, like Calvin's saints, waspish, pragmatic, poor, gripping the devil's pitchfork, stare rigidly towards the immortal wheat.
You're listening to Soundings, a magazine about books and ideas from the National Humanities Center. I'm Wayne Pond. My guest this week was Nobel laureate Derek Walcott. He read from his collected poems. That was a selection entitled Elegy. Cassette tapes of this program are available for $10 postpaid. Please write to Soundings, the National Humanities Center, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina. Our zip code is 27709. Ask for program number 773. That's program number 773. Our address again is Soundings, the National Humanities Center, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina. Our zip code again, 27709. We're interested in your comments and suggestions. Our email address is sounding, S-O-U-N-D-I-N-G, at uncecs.edu. Next week on Soundings, the latest from writer Tim McLaurin. He'll be here to read from and talk about his latest novel. It's a book called Cured by Fire. Until next week's show, thanks for listening to Soundings. Partial support for this program comes from Carolina Power and Light, where listening generates powerful ideas. Our theme music is by Jeff Perry. Soundings is a cultural affairs service of the National Humanities Center. Walcott on Poetry, this week on Soundings. I'm Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center. Derek Walcott is a West Indian poet and playwright. He won the Nobel Prize for Literature in 1992. He'll be here this week to read two selections from his collected poems. He'll also talk about his work and reflect on the role of poetry in today's global economy and mass culture. Derek Walcott on Poetry, readings and conversation featuring Nobel laureate Derek Walcott, this week on Soundings.